Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to the Stick Show. This is Lisa Anderson. Let me, first of all, we're in the summer, y'all, which means that we have later on this summer coming up our 500th episode of The Boundless Show. Can you even believe it? In August, that's going to happen. Coming up very quickly. And we still need your impact stories. So write to us, editor@boundless.org, with just a short few sentences of kind of your favorite moment from The Boundless Show or some kind of impact it had on you. Maybe it changed your thinking on a certain topic. Maybe, you know, whatever, just something that you thought was great. Like, why do you even listen? And so let us know. Write to us at editor@boundless.org. Send us your story. Put 500th in the subject line so I don't have to wade through all these like spam subject lines, people. And then tell us your story. You may be included in the show. Later on, this show coming up, we have our own Dr. Greg Smalley. He's going to answer a question from someone who is keeping a secret from their fiancé. Okay, so he is going to infuse some wisdom into that. And then for our culture, very excited to have Eric Metaxas here. He is radio host, speaker, author of Bonhoeffer. Many of you know that, but as well as a number of other books. And we're going to talk about his book, If You Can Keep It. If you don't even know what that means, Google it. You will understand the reference. All right, for our roundtable, because we are in the throes of summer, really just starting it off, thank goodness, because I love summer. There are a lot of like parties, events. We know we're in wedding season. We know we have a lot of stuff going on. And so we want to talk about how to do parties well. Now, I was going to say do them as a Christian, but that sounds super like legalistic and weird. And so I'm just going to say, how do we do parties well? You know, if you have been invited to or thrown your own bachelor, bachelorette party, wedding reception, landmark birthday party, Friday night, summer bash, whatever, you probably, you know, want to find a way to do it and to have fun and be with your friends, but also not compromise in any way or get crazy or whatever. And even just socially, let's talk about some ideas of how to make this work, especially if you're with different personalities and stuff like that. So I am very excited to have as part of this roundtable, Brandon is back. Hey, Brandon.
Hello.
Hello. Also, Britta and Nathan. Hey, guys.
Hello. Hello.
They are interning with us this summer here at Focus on the Family. Great to have them in our space. And so the first thing, okay, let's just kick off by saying, I mean, we all have different kind of experiences with how this is playing out, whether past, I mean, you two are in college, so I'm sure there's some, okay, but you go, okay, Nathan, you go to a Christian college, so hopefully
yep.
People aren't getting too crazy with parties there.
Not too
there.
Crazy.
Not too, okay, well, we're going to uncover some of that. We'll see if you're even telling the truth. Britta, where do you go to school?
I go to Dort College, which is also a Christian.
Also a Christian. And that is like in Iowa, so there's nothing that can go on. Although I hear that the Midwest people are the craziest. Because they're like, cow tipping and drinking and stuff. So wow.
We are in the middle of the cornfields.
Wow. We're going to find out what's going on there. And then Brandon, you are getting married.
I am.
Yep. In, you said it was what, 60 days?
60 days,
yep. Oh, my word. Okay, so he's getting married, and we want to hear about your totally crazy bachelor party that you have coming up.
Excellent. And okay. I did go to a Christian college, and we did not party in a Christian manner. So it does happen.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, true confessions. So tell us about, actually, let's just kick it off by telling, what do you have, like, leading up to the wedding? What kind of, because you're right in the midst of this, what kind
yes.
of conversations have you had around how you're going to give everyone a good time without
right.
Ensuring or with sure. While still ensuring that, you know, people don't get too crazy.
Too crazy. Yeah. So I have four groomsmen, all are married, all are Christian. So that's kind of nice. Mm-hmm. Not one is younger, but the rest of them are all kind of, you know, late 20s mm-hmm. into their 30s. So, you know, it's, I don't know. I feel like personally you hit a point in your life where you just don't want to even think about trying to go crazy. It seems like too much work, too much effort.
Yeah.
So,
and it can be expensive.
And it can be very expensive. Yeah. So we're just going to, I don't know. I don't want it to be, I hate having people feel like they have to plan something crazy or, you know, live up to some expectation. So my conversations with my best man who's coming in from California are just like, you know what? We just go play golf or just go, you know, to a Rockies game or something that's just where we can just have community, you know, in the afternoon. The way it's playing out that we'll do the rehearsal kind of the next day. So we really only have one day, and there's a lot of other stuff that has to get done in between that. So it'll just be a relaxful afternoon, most likely.
Okay. And then what are you doing for your wedding reception?
Wedding reception, we're not having alcohol.
Okay.
So that was a decision my fiance and I made, more from kind of her experiences in her family side. Mm-hmm. I'm not opposed to it. I think you can use it in moderation, but it doesn't need to be the focal point, the center point of having fun. I know even in my early college days, that seemed to be, you know, what everything was built around. That, like, you couldn't have fun unless you got drunk. And it's like, it's not the case. You know, people are there to celebrate you. I know at weddings, sometimes there's expectations that, you know, you're throwing a party for them and, you know, they'll be mad if you don't have it. It's like, well, if that's the case for them, then, you know, they can choose not to come. But we feel like we can have fun. We can dance. We can have a good time without, you know, going crazy.
Okay. And Britta and Nate weigh in here too. What would you say has been your experience? Like, let's just talk about the gamut of party going, party planning, like what we've been invited to, what you've gone to, what, you know, Brandon, you said, you know, back in the day, probably a different story for you. I know I used to work, when I worked in the secular workplace, there was always that awkward, you knew that, you know, even going out after work was going to end up, you know, involving alcohol. And so how do you, you know, walk that line? Forget after work, even during the workday. Let's be honest here, some people. So kind of just figuring out, like, paint us a picture of kind of what that scene looks like. Like, what has been your experience and expectations as you've moved through birthday parties, you know, engagement parties, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I'll start. I have not had too much of an experience. A lot of the friends that I have made at APU have been more along the lines of...
That's Azusa Pacific.
Azusa Pacific University, sorry.
In California.
A lot of them have been pretty much just been avoiding alcohol since they've been raised, or, you know, their parents don't completely shelter them from it, but don't let them do it, and just, they don't make it to be a complete demon, but warn them, you know, we want to abide by the laws, so 21, and we want to make sure that things are going safe. So party scene wise, I've only been to a few, and they were pretty tame. You know, nothing crazy, just, you know, a large group of friends, and we all know each other. We're all just hanging out. You know, we're dancing, or we're, you know, playing, you know, Just Dance. I don't know if I'm allowed to name drop video game titles, but we're, you know,
I'm not familiar with this one.
Yeah. It's just a dancing game where you dance to pop songs.
Okay.
It's pretty silly. You look kind of silly doing it, but it's a lot of fun.
Okay.
With my experience at alcohol parties, it's pretty much just been something to, get a little looser, but we make sure that we're holding each other accountable to not go over the line, and we're making sure that that we're legal, first of all, but that we are all trying to be as safe as we can and doing it in moderation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How about you, Britta?
Some of my best friends are on the cross-country team along with me, so we are not allowed to drink during the season, and the friends that I have made don't really have interest in drinking, and so this past spring I was able to plan a bachelorette party for two of my closest friends. There's 10 of us girls, and it was super fun. We went to Omaha for the weekend, and went out to dinner on Friday night, and then went to some hole-in-the-wall place, and the people who do like drinking wine had a glass of wine, and then after that we went back to the hotel and just played games and hung out on the weekends at Dort. It's so funny that Nathan brought up Just Dance, because at Dort we like to have a lot of fun, and we play Just Dance often. So the things that my friends and I do on weekends is usually baking is involved, whether it is cookies or brownies. We have to eat this good sweets. And then
I was going to say you can't get too crazy with baking, but here in Colorado you can. Let me just be honest, okay? I'm just telling you. But
yeah, we are in Colorado, but I go to school in Iowa, so we're not as crazy as that. And Just Dance is often one of the first games that we play, or Fishbowl. It's always a popular one. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Fishbowl.
No.
Brendan and I are like, we are ancients. Okay. No, what's Fishbowl?
It is a game, and it has three different phases. One phase is charades. One phase is catchphrase. And the other phase is you can only make noises of the word that you pull out of the bowl. Oh. But the words are repeated through the three phases. So once you get to the sound phase, you can kind of pick up what word that is trying to be guessed.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's very funny that you guys mention like playing games, because I think that is something that if you did not, like if anyone out there is listening and you didn't grow up like in youth group or you went to like a Christian college, I found that like my friends who aren't believers, when I talk about game nights and I invite them to play games, they're like, what's that? Like they don't even know what I'm talking about. They really just do go hang out at bars and stuff. In fact, one of my good friends invited a couple of her coworkers to go to join a bunch of us for a game night, and they're like, you could tell they didn't really know what to talk about. And then they're like, well, Rachel just broke up with her boyfriend, so we were going to go to a strip club, so do you want to join us? And then she's all like, I don't actually, but, you know, and so it's the weird dance of like, how do you say, oh, I'm so sorry you broke up, but no, I don't really want to go to a strip club, so, but you clearly don't know what a game night is, so how are we going to come to common ground here? So, I don't know, but what was the scene? Brendan, describe the scene of what you said you did in college and just, I mean, how...
Yeah, I mean, we signed a life. So I went to George Fox, which is in just south of Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. So a Christian college, signed a lifestyle agreement. But we just did, a lot of it was just off campus. So we would go to off campus parties, or we'd go to Portland, or in the first 2 years, I was a better student, you know, focused on studies. And then you kind of creep toward that 20-year-old mark and, you know, you just start. I think it depends, you know, for me, I was more of a follower. So I found acceptance through friends that I could kind of like find a shared enjoyment or, you know, doing something like that. So I didn't say get bad. It got pretty consistent in like senior year, you know, where we would just be going out on the weekends and just making sure, and dangerous in some senses too. So we're driving 30, 40 miles to go.
Did you like create a fake ID?
No.
Or, okay.
No. We just had other ways to kind of make it work. But
yeah. Hashtag other ways.
I'm not proud of it. I look back and see kind of how God worked even in that season. At times where I probably shouldn't be alive, but God, you know, was really watching out for us. And to use it just as part of a testimony or a ministry, but it's not something if I could choose to do it again, I don't think I would.
Well, and I think it's like by the time you are in our audience, so like let's say, you know, college, 20-somethings, whatever, it's like you know whether you tend to be a follower or a leader type, you know? And so, I mean, I'm just telling all of you followers, like, figure that out ahead of time, because you're going to have to decide that you have to be strong in that, because it's not going to come natural to you to be like, no, let me just buck the tide of all my friends who are going to do this and choose to do something else. I mean, you can, again, you know, Brandon has long said he's an introvert. He's more of a follower type, but, you know.
And just surrounding it doesn't mean I didn't have a strong group of Christians that were serious about their faith either. And I know that doesn't necessarily mean anything either, but I think it's that influence too, and to be able to be confident enough to take a stand to say no, I'm drawing my line here, you know, whether that be making sure if you are drinking that you don't cross that line, or just abstaining completely, that's usually the safer route.
So. Yeah. Okay. What would you guys say? It looks like, let's just talk about just party planning in general. Like, I know I was just talking with a friend the other day who is planning a big birthday party or wants to throw a big birthday party for herself and have a ton of friends from different walks of life over. But she's kind of like, I'm afraid to do it because I'm afraid that either one, no one will show up, or two, everyone will show up. And then I've got my like mountain climbing friends who are just like full on crazy, most of them not believers. And then I've got my church friends who some of them are grandmas who will probably perish at the conversation of the others. And she said, and on top of that, I don't even know how to do parties, so I think I'll just be overwhelmed and I won't even know what to do. I mean, what would you guys say, like, from stuff you've gone to in the past or something you've planned, what has just been a really fun, like, some of the most fun social times for you, whether they are parties, whether they're just groups of friends getting together? What has been the most successful?
I think for me, it's been the most fun when, even as awkward as a situation that puts you in, when you plan your own party or you plan it with someone else and it's people from different, have different interests, it's more fun when the person who is about the birthday boy or girl, when they're having the most fun. Because I know that I've been to a few birthday parties where we've had a lot of different people from who have a lot of different interests, people who know that they're not interested in some things or others, but we are all there to celebrate this one person. And when they're having fun, you know, kind of we're having fun and they're, you know, it's their day, they're happy. So, you know, we want to do the best we can to just make their day great.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Something I would say is some of my fondest memories so far at Dort have been the spontaneous get-togethers with huge groups of people, both guys and girls, where we get off campus and have a big bonfire. And so we'll hike around the area and explore a new area or a campground. And then once it gets dark, have a bonfire and do fire or bonfire games or sing songs and just be crazy while having s'mores. There always has to be food involved. But those are some of the times that I will cherish for a long time.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I like to do it around sporting events or something that you can have, you know, whether it's like a Super Bowl or just some type of shared sport that you like where people can watch. It's there's not really a, I personally don't like to be either forced or expected. You know, like I never want someone to feel like, oh, I have to do this or I have to, you know, play this game if they're really introverted. So just having it be just a really casual experience where you might have games out people can play or you're watching a game or you're just you're just eating food and talking or something like that. Yeah. But it's, I don't go to a whole lot of parties. So
I went, you'll like this. Well, you actually like going to games too.
I do,
like in
yeah.
person and
I
stuff.
Do,
yeah. Okay, so I went to a Super Bowl party once where and I'd actually helped plan this because I did not know a thing about football at the time. Like now I'm a total expert, of course. I've been watching for like a year or two. So, but we had in the house, we had one room where people could play games, one room where they could watch Pride and Prejudice, and then one room where the game was on. And it was so great because everyone felt like they could come, but the people that didn't care about football could do their own thing. And then we could all gather around snacks and stuff. And so it did provide something for everyone that kind of made it a fun combo of things and stuff. So, okay. What about like, looking at parties, thinking like, let's get back to, you know, summer parties or weddings, you know, receptions, those kind of parties and stuff. What would you say is like some ideas for if you're going to one of those and maybe you don't know a lot of people, what's a great way to still kind of feel like you fit in and have a good time and kind of craft your own experience, even though you may be dreading the party itself?
At least for our reception, I know we're going to make sure we have games and different things for people to do because I know there is going to be you have two sides of a family coming together and then friends as well. So there's going to be people that don't know. So just try to make it as socially welcoming as possible so that people feel comfortable and not, you know, like they're, you know, we'll do some games even in the reception. You know, we're doing like the shoe game and just things that can get people like generational dance, get people involved and kind of to try to kind of build community that way. I think it's a nice way to try to have things that include, you know, a larger amount of people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And at a summer hangout or a wedding reception, people are, for something like a summer hangout, people are looking for something to do. So if you're the one to suggest the game, people are going to be on board with that, whether it's a word game, so you don't need any cards or anything, or if it's a card game or something outside, it's always fun to organize that if you're willing to kind of step out of your comfort zone and don't know a lot of people, or if you're at a wedding reception and there's a dance going on or other games, invite someone. Everyone wants to be invited or wants to do something, but you might have to be the one to step out and ask.
Mm-hmm. I'm not the biggest party planner, and most of the interns won't believe me, but I'm also very introverted. From a planning perspective, I know what I'd like to try to do is get friends who have very different personalities, that we're still close friends, but I'm an introvert, they're an extrovert, or I like to sit inside and they like to go outside, that kind of thing. And seeing what, you know, people can come up with together, coming from that different, those different perspectives. From an attendee perspective, I love to try and do the buddy system. So finding one or two people that, I think like they're playing that game, I kind of like that game, I'm going to go talk to this one person. And then maybe that person will go, hey, this is my fiance, this is my friend, this is, you know, so-and-so. And they'll introduce you to more people. So maybe a little advice to introverts out there. But so the buddy system works great.
Yeah, I think that's also great when you have both Christian friends and non-Christian friends that are coming, especially if some of my Christian friends have helped plan the party. I always let them know who's coming, who may not know other people or who may not be a Christian, so that they can specifically seek them out and have a conversation with them. So, you know, some other person doesn't just randomly come up and be like, you know, drop some total Christianese on them. So just, you know, got my people in place to kind of run interference on that. So, but these are good ideas, you guys. Thanks. Hopefully all of you out there, as we get parties in full swing, will give us your ideas on the blog. So hop over to boundless.org to do that. You make me so mad, I want to throw a stone. You make me so sad, I want to hide away alone. Can you meet me? Folks, we are here for our culture segment, and as you know, I always love it when I can introduce you to a new friend, though maybe you have already been introduced to him. His name is Eric Metaxas. Eric, welcome to the Boundless Show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I guess it's, you know, we've had your colleague John Stone Street a couple times, and I guess we finally decided that you deserve to be on the Boundless Show, or we're going to give you a shot anyway.
Thank you. We'll see what we can do.
We'll see how it goes. For those of you who don't know, many of you probably know Eric because he's the author of the book Bonhoeffer. That's where most of the folks, all you out there in our boundless sphere, have kind of had touch points with us about his work, a very well-known New York Times bestseller. But he's also an author, speaker, radio host. He hosts a nationally syndicated radio program, The Eric Metaxas Show, as well as being an occasional college lecturer and contributor speaker around the U.S. and the world. And so not sure how you fit all this stuff in. That's pretty awesome.
Thank you for being impressed. I don't know how I fit it in either, but I have no choice.
Yeah.
This is just what God has given me to do, and I try to be faithful to it all. It's not always easy, but I enjoy doing all these different kinds of things. The radio program has been amazing. I mean, it just started 2 years ago, and I'm on all over the country. People listen around the world, and I thought, this is, you know, I never thought I would enjoy it so much. So obviously now I'm a guest, but normally I'm interviewing people, and it's been an extraordinary thing. People listen on podcasts to that too, but that has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, that is fun. I actually got to be on your show, I want to say it was about a year ago, about dating. We were talking about dating, because I'd had my book come out recently, and so it was fun to be able to connect there.
Yes.
And then I actually got, someone gave me your book, Seven Women, for Christmas, FYI. And I was going to bring it, I just went on a cruise, and I was going to bring it and read it, but then I was kind of like, it's kind of weird to be reading Seven Women on the beach in Curacao. Like, I felt like I should be reading something fluffier or something, so it was kind of weird to feel like I was pulling it out. So I did bring it, and, you know, But it wasn't quite
the
beach.
It turned out to be pretty fluffy, right?
Well, it wasn't quite the beach read I was expecting, you know. But,
No, definitely not.
But I appreciated that. So, all right, well, we're going to go. I already warned you that we're going to go a little bit all over the map, because I want to talk about, we are heading into the 4th of July here in the U.S. And you actually authored a book called If You Can Keep It, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty. And I want to talk around a couple of the themes there in that book. The first thing I wanted to ask, though, we're going to come back to that. I mentioned in your bio all the things you've done. You've been a book author, a radio host, a script writer, including around children's books, as well as writing for the super fabulous Chuck Colson back in the day. You've been an editor, a cultural commentator. Which of all those things that you have done would you say is your favorite, your most niche sweet spot of who you are and what you love to do? You have to pick one.
I absolutely cannot. They're all of a piece. They sound so different, but the reality is that they're all part of who I am and what I do. I mean, I'm most passionate about my faith, but faith is supposed to express itself in everything, and so I try to express my faith in all different media and in all different genres, and that's just who God made me to be, and each one is wonderful in a different way. It's like trying to pick your favorite child. You know, I think that you really can't. It's just some are easier, but you don't love them more because they're easier. It's just I really believe God made me to do all these things.
Okay. You also went, I should also mention, you went to Yale. You and I have that in common in that I actually almost went to Yale, but then I didn't. So,
well, I'm not a big fan of Yale, and people act like it's some big deal, and I'll be honest with you, in a worldly sense, it's a great credential, but those schools, a lot of what I do, the impetus for a lot of what I do is to help people understand that the worldview that comes out of elite institutions and that exists in the cultural leadership in the West is very messed up. They have really lost their way. They're out of touch with you know, the common men and women who are just trying to get by in the world, and it's really creating problems, and especially with regard to values, sexuality, they're very, very out of touch, and they've been kind of pushing an agenda for decades, and it's a huge pity because these are places that are supposed to be objective, that are supposed to help people learn how to think, and they've really lost their way. I don't know if they were ever much better at it, but my guess is that they were.
Yeah. So maybe I'm better off for not having gone. I was actually waitlisted. I went through the whole interview, actually came out of my interview, ran into a pole as I was saying goodbye to the alum who interviewed me. And so
that might have been what saved you from, you know, becoming a very messed up person. So
it's very possible. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about America. Cause like I said, you know, we are heading into our Independence Day here in the U.S. I want to talk about, okay, backing up. I know you get asked this a lot, I'm sure, but think of this in the context of a young adult audience, the people out there in our sphere who are college students, 20 and 30 something, things, professionals trying to navigate this landscape. We just came off of an election where basically it practically made people lose their salvation. And that is saying something because I'm reformed. So that's a tough, that's a pretty stark thing for me to say.
Right.
But I now have, if I'm on social media and I'm talking about fans of this show, I'm talking about people I go to church with, people I went to school with, whatever, who marched in the Women's March, who have blown up things on social media, have taken sides. Obviously now we have had people opening fire on congressmen.
Right.
You know, I mean, stuff going on in the news in our country here. Eric, it is almost in vogue to distrust America and our leadership at this point in history. How did we get here, and why are we no longer dignified? This sense of dignity that we had in the founding of our nation, and there, it seems that we have lost it. I think the millennial generation.
I mean, I talk about this all the time, and I wrote about it in this book, If You Can Keep It. I think it has to do with the fact that we have not been teaching. Something happened in the 60s, and I'm a result of that. In the 70s, 70s, they stopped teaching the basic idea of patriotism, love your country. You had a ridiculous choice between a thoughtless patriotism, like America, love it or leave it, and don't criticize it, or criticize it 24/7, it's bad, it's bad, it's bad. That's a really false choice. And it's like telling a kid that your parents are the worst thing ever, or your parents can never do wrong. There's something really sick about that, you know? And when you're talking about loving your country, it doesn't mean you approve of everything. But if you can only criticize it, something is out of whack. Most people in the history of the world have loved their hometowns, their tribes, their countries, their families, with all the warts and problems. And I think that something happened in the 60s where we began to undermine some of the institutions and some of the traditions that were actually vital to keeping the republic. The title of my book, If You Can Keep It, comes from Benjamin Franklin, who was asked right after the Constitutional Convention, they just created the government, they just created the Constitution, and a woman asked Dr. Franklin, she said, "What have you given us, a monarchy or a republic?" And he said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And he was quite serious because he understood that self-government is incredibly fragile. It actually means the people have to govern themselves. Well, we've ceased understanding what that means. We've ceased understanding that it's a huge responsibility, that if you want to live in a country that's really free and you want to have real freedom, you have to understand how it works, what it is. That's a lot of that stuff I didn't get growing up in public schools, and then when you go off to a college like Yale, they're actively teaching against it. They have a very sneering, negative attitude toward America or toward the West or to any of the sort of older institutions, which, as I say, it becomes very unhealthy. It's one thing to question, but if you don't ever stop questioning and settle on the truth or what you think is the best answer, something is wrong. And so I think that that really began in the 60s. You can sort of trace it. And because of Watergate, there are many good reasons that these things happened, but the fact that they carried on as they did has undermined the basic institutions of the republic. For example, the press has really lost credibility with middle America. That's bad for America. America needs to have a media that it can trust to be generally unbiased, generally fair. And so when you feel like these folks are in the tank for that candidate and these folks are in the tank for that candidate, it's simply not healthy for the country. When people are criticizing a president as though he's the devil, I know that people really hate Trump. And speaking as a Christian, I have to say, listen, even if I really strongly disagree with somebody, I'm commanded to love my enemies, which means not to agree with them. It means I can fight with them, but I don't fight the way the world fights. I have to treat them with grace, with some dignity. We're not talking about Hitler. And people who compare Trump to Hitler, all they do for me is reveal their tremendous historical ignorance. It's embarrassing to me that people say, "Well, in your book, Eric Bonhoeffer, you practically, you know, blah, blah, blah." And it's like, yeah, practically, but I don't, you know. Yeah. It's a really different thing. And if you understand the way American government works and our traditions and our history, and then you look at where Germany was, it's just ridiculous. It's laughable, except for the fact that so many people's, you know, understanding of history is so shallow. So I wrote If You Can Keep It because I said, we have got to teach the basics. If people want to think clearly and if they want to, you know, fight politically, they've got to do it the right way. They've got to understand the rules. If you just want to blow everything up, everybody loses. Everybody loses. Nobody wins. And that's where we're going to go. You're going to get the French Revolution. And, you know, I think that we've had it so good in America that we forget how bad it can get. It can get really, really bad. Whatever we have now, the worst of what we have now is nothing compared to how bad it can be in some countries and how it's been bad historically in some countries. So what we have is really fragile. My parents came from Europe to this country. They really had an appreciation for this country that I think a lot of Americans don't have. And in my book, it was my way of saying, I'm ashamed of how ignorant I have been and how ungrateful I have been of the freedoms that I have, and I want to help my fellow Americans at least see the basics. And I think if we don't do it soon, we're all going to be in trouble. And I do mean both sides of the political aisle because, you know, I, even though I'm in some ways conservative, I really hugely respect certain liberal positions, but I think the Democratic Party has has lost its way, and we're in a bad place right now. So I felt it was time for a book like this.
Yeah. Well, help us understand. Let's back up a little bit because, you know, you mentioned us being woefully ignorant of history and all of that, which is true. I went through the California public schools, so let's just be honest right there. We understand America is different from, say, the Sudan. Okay, but yeah. How is America different from other first world nations? I think a lot of even Christian young adults today here in the country don't understand the uniqueness of our nation, its founding, and what its principles are. Because I mentioned to you I'm Scandinavian. I have a good chunk of my family is in Norway. They are like, you need to come to Norway. We have the highest standard of living in the world. We're going to take care of you with our socialism. We're amazing.
Yeah.
We love salmon, you know, whatever. It just sounds so amazing. What make the case, Eric, for why the uniqueness of the United States of America?
Well, in this country, we have something called freedom. And they tell you that they have freedom in a lot of these countries. But let's take Germany, for example, right? Great country. But my Bonhoeffer book, when it came out in America, it's like it listed for like $30, but everywhere you could buy it for like $14 or $15, it was discounted by Amazon and whatever. There's something called the free market, right? In Germany, they tell you, you cannot discount the book. Even if you want to, even if you think you'll sell more copies by selling it for $20 than $30, no way, you have to sell it at the list price. And when I was over there, because my book was translated into German, it was the first language that it was translated into, I said, are you kidding? It's against the law to discount the book? You mean a bookseller can't himself or herself determine what they want to sell something for? And the answer was absolutely not. We do not have that freedom over here. And that just gave me a taste of how bizarre these countries can be, that we have more freedom in this country and have had more freedom. But again, freedom comes with a price. It means that there's stuff you've got to do. In those countries, they have such high taxes that giving is way down, right? Because the government does all the giving. Now, do you want to live in a world where the government decides which charities get money? Shouldn't we, the people, be able to decide, like, I want to give money to this organization or that organization? In those countries, the government takes care of everything. So in a way, they take care of it for you. But what that means is you no longer have the freedom to choose. And it's really gross. I mean, as an American, when you begin to see this, you think, wow, people there have way less money, basically. They have way less freedom to how to spend their money, because most of it goes to the government, who decides how it's going to get spent. You know, there's some upsides to that, but I think the downsides are much, much worse. And I even, you know, think to myself, in this country, if you have a great idea, you just watch Shark Tank, if you've got some great idea in this country, you can work really hard and you can figure out a way to create a company and create jobs and you know, make a lot of money and create a lot of jobs and help a lot of other people make money. In Europe, that is like impossible. The regulations that they have, it's just a whole different thing. And that's just, believe me, that's just a few seconds worth. But it's really something that, unless you travel around the world and you see these things for yourself, it's bad. Having a bureaucracy make decisions for you, that's really not, in the end, going to be a good thing. Sometimes things last for a little while. I can give you another example from my Bonhoeffer book. In Germany, they didn't have freedom of religion. They really had a state church in Germany, right? So the head of the government was also sort of the head of the church. And that works just fine if the head of the church is the Kaiser, who was a pretty decent Christian guy. But what if the head of the government suddenly becomes a guy named Adolf Hitler? What if the government controls the churches, and now the government suddenly is controlled by Adolf Hitler? If you don't have a separation of church and state now, you are in big trouble. And the church was destroyed under Adolf Hitler. And it's not just because he was a bad guy. It's because his fundamental values were against the church, and he had the power given to him by that form of government to do that. That's an amazing thing. You could think about even in Greece, where my dad grew up. You know, my mom's from Germany, but in Greece, in the 80s, I had a guy that I knew who was an evangelist. He traveled around the world. He was a missionary to Irian Jaya. He was working with cannibals, and it was just an amazing man. He was preaching on the streets in Greece as a Greek person in Greek. He was arrested, and there was a huge trial because they said, in this country, everybody's Greek Orthodox. We can't preach evangelicalism on the streets in this country, so you go to jail. Now, you think to yourself, where's the freedom? In this country, we believe that people should be able to say what they want and have the freedom to debate ideas and those kinds of things. Even in Europe, that's incredibly reduced from what we have here. But again, I just think like we're so used to what we have here that we kind of think the rest of the world is the same as we are. But if you live there for, you know, more than a month, you will see that what we have here is really fragile.
Yeah. You, in the book, you actually make much of a culture's need for heroes and kind of talk about how that whole concept and the heroes of character and whatever have been lost kind of in recent decades, if not even before that. What would you say? First of all, I want you to tell the story about running through Central Park and taking note of the statues.
Wow, you really read my book. I appreciate that. Well, I guess what I was saying is that there was a tradition years ago where we had a lot of representational art and where we would have statues of great people. Somebody mm-hmm. would do something great and we'd build a statue. You know, we weren't afraid of saying so-and-so was a great person. Now, whenever you say something like that, people always say, yeah, but... And then they give you all the bad stuff that person did. And you think, well, wait a second. Are you saying, like, everybody's equal, like Stalin and Hitler are no different than Mother Teresa? Like, in God's eyes, we're all sinners. But don't you think that there's a place in a culture to revere people for the sacrifices they made? Somebody dies for his country or someone, does something really noble. We shouldn't celebrate that. And really what's happened is we have stopped celebrating those things. We've stopped telling the stories of Paul Revere and Nathan Hale and George Washington, whatever. We've kind of said, well, you know, there's things there that we don't like. It's part of a patriarchal culture. And we're sort of reinventing that history in a way that I think is very, very harmful, because there are some people who suffered greatly so that we could have the freedoms we have. We need to at least give them that. And it doesn't mean you worship them like they're gods or anything like that, and it doesn't mean that you sugarcoat their failings. But, you know, to a 10-year-old doesn't need to know the details of George Washington being a slaveholder. That can come later. But I think we need to teach our kids that this person did a great thing. This person sacrificed a lot of power because he believed in the idea of liberty. And we don't really do that anymore. Something came in the 60s that basically said we're gonna praise anti-heroes. We're gonna have these anti-heroes that are kind of dark and kind of whatever. And we lost some innocence. I think of movies like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's such a beautiful movie. I write about it in my book. I think every American should see that movie because it doesn't sugarcoat the problems of America, but it shows you that this kind of innocence, this idealism, is not lost. We don't have to be cynical. People can get cynical too easily, and I think that that's a big problem. The love of innocence and the idea that we can be beautiful and true and noble and good, and those things have not disappeared as virtues. We have to sing their praises, and we have to do our best, knowing we'll fail, but we really have to pay attention to them. Actually, one thing in the book that I talk about a lot is the relationship between virtue and freedom. I never knew about that till a few years ago, and when it finally dawned on me that I didn't know this, I was so ashamed. I said, this is at the very heart of American liberty, and I have spent my whole life not getting this because it was not taught to me. It's not in the movies. And it's something that every single one of the founders said, unless we have this, unless we get this, America can't work. So we've been going along for 200 years, and then the last 40 years, we're pretty much going on fumes. So I wrote If You Can Keep It, because I said, if we don't get this like yesterday, we're dead. This cannot go on forever.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the problem is some of these folks, George Washington, Nathan Hale, who you outline, they don't have Instagram accounts. And so people cannot. I mean, the word hero is synonymous with sports star and celebrities right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. Well, that's really bad. That's really, really bad for the culture. But it's because we've divorced things from virtue.
Yeah.
Hero is not somebody like, you know, did something like, you know, jumped the farthest or ran the quickest. Like, that's one one level of, you know, you respect those people because they work really hard. But the idea of virtue, when you think that Nathan Hale died for his country, and what country? He died so that we could be free. He didn't just die for his country, for his tribe. He died for liberty. We have to celebrate those things. And if we don't, we all lose. That's the key. We all lose. The link between virtue and freedom, when I understood that, as I said, I was really blown away. I said, how have I spent most of my life not getting something that every single one of the founders said, you cannot have liberty for very long unless the people, if they're going to govern themselves, they have to have a measure of virtue. We have to teach virtue in the schools. We are not going to be able to force people to be virtuous. Virtue is free. You have to do it because you want to. That's what makes it virtue. But if we don't stress virtue and make people understand that they have to do the right thing when nobody's looking, we will need to be governed by somebody besides ourselves. So self-government goes away, and then you have a bureaucracy, or you have a monarch or a tyrant. That idea is such a big idea and such a simple idea. I never heard that. And also, all of the founders praised faith. They said faith and virtue always go together. So if you want virtue to preserve freedom, you have to have faith, but you can't force the faith. The faith has to be free. So you have to have religious freedom. You cannot tell people what to think, whether to go to church, where to go to church. You have, the government has to stay out of that. And there are so many ideas that are really basic that I didn't learn. So when I learned them in recent years, I was really so shocked and ashamed. I said, I haven't loved my country. I haven't understood that what I have here, most people in the world would do anything to have the freedoms that we have. And so we should appreciate them and preserve them. And the reason we have them, by the way, the reason I would say God gave them to us, is so we could share them with the world, not to keep to ourselves. That the world deserves these ideas as much as America does. That these are ideas, you know, they're meant to be spread. These ideas of liberty and self-government are not for America only. So when people talk about America first, that's okay as long as they understand that it's America first so that we have the ability to share what we have, because God only gives us gifts to share. He doesn't just say, I'm just giving this to you because, you know, you're better than anybody else. You know, he chose the Jews. Why did he choose the Jews? He chose them to be his vehicle to the whole world, so that the Messiah would come out of the Jews and that the entire world would worship the God of the Jews. So Lincoln calls America God's almost chosen people, and what he's saying is that there's something special about this country, but it's because it's not just meant for us. It's meant for everybody in the world. And as the son of immigrants, you know, I get that, and I'm obviously passionate about that. I think that we've not been teaching this. And by the way, when you read my book, If You Can Keep It, these are exciting and inspiring stories. It's not dull, and that's the other shock. I thought, this is not a hard sell. These are really inspiring, true stories. We just have stopped teaching them.
Yeah. Okay, so you just touched on this, but I want you to actually spell it out for our audience, and then we're going to turn a corner, and I'm going to ask you some random stuff that you're not prepared for.
Right.
Okay, what? I need you to underscore this. So then how do American Christians balance an appreciation for our freedoms and heritage with the understanding that Christian and American are not synonyms? Okay, so that...
Oh, well, absolutely. Okay. But, you know, again, you always get this false choice. Like, people say, you know, Jesus didn't die for America, he died for the whole world. Well, what are you going to say to that? Duh, of course. But that's like saying, don't take care of your house, because what about everybody else's house? I mean, you've got to take care of your house. You've got to make sure the door is locked at night because there's evil in the world. You've got to make sure that the people you let into your house are people that you want in your house, that they're not going to burn down the house. I mean, it's basic stuff, but when you talk about it now, people look at you like, well, what does that mean? You're a xenophobe or you're a racist or whatever. I mean, everybody should be able to stand against real racism and real xenophobia. That's, the Bible is basically all about that. And I wrote a book about William Wilberforce, who spent his whole life working against the slave trade and the British Empire and against slavery. And so, you know, these are things that you have to, it's a little more complex than do you choose Jesus or George Washington. That's, to me, that's really silly. The question is, do you choose leaders and do you choose a form of government that enables us to be free so that we can worship God? Because I would challenge anybody that if you think persecution is good and you don't care, move to North Korea tomorrow. Move there tomorrow. You'll be persecuted for your faith. Your faith will grow. And, you know, what can I tell you? The point is that God's will is not that people be tortured for their faith. If it happens, God works with it, and he's close to those who are suffering. But do you want your parents and your friends to be tortured for their faith, to be killed for their faith? Clearly, it's God's will that everybody be able to be free. And this country has uniquely provided freedom for everybody, for every Jew, for every atheist. That's, we have always stood for that, and we stand for it now, actually, way more than we ever did. And I say that is beautiful, that we don't say that we want to be a Christian nation. We want to be a nation for everybody. And so that's, you know, there's a relationship between the openness of the Christian faith, the real openness. I just wrote a book about Martin Luther and this idea that we've all got to be able to choose our own faith. You can't force faith. Well, America was the first country ever to enshrine the idea of religious liberty. It's the first country that said, we might even disagree with you, but we are not going to force you to attend this church or that church or even to go to church. You can think what you want. That is so beautiful. And ironically, it comes right out of the Bible. So I think that, you know, you need more education on this. People are making it way too simple, and they're making it sound like, well, I'm a Christian, it's not about being an American. You know, that's like saying, like, I'm a father, I'm not a husband. Like, you're a father and a husband and a son and a cousin, and like, you can handle all those things. You don't need to like pick one thing. But, you know, if you're living in a world of sound bites and tweets, that's kind of where we devolve to.
Yeah. Okay, folks, the book is If You Can Keep It, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty. It's actually available. We have copies. We want to get a copy into your hands. So for a gift of any amount to Focus on the Family, hop over to boundless.org. You will see the photo of the book. Your gift is to, you know, to Boundless, to what we're doing here with young adults. We will get a copy of this book in your hands. Okay, so make sure you make that happen. Okay, Eric, I'm going to turn a corner really quick. I want to ask you a few questions. These are kind of the types of questions that when I think of our audience and I'm like, if they were just sitting somewhere in Central Park chilling with Eric, what would they ask? And then I realized that no one would really ask him. I'm just the one asking him. Because I just come up with questions. I just am very curious about
okay,
people.
Okay, so, good, good. I love it.
Okay, you were married at 33 to your wife, Suzanne.
Yes.
And although you're an advocate of younger marriage, which I find to be kind of lame given that you were married at 33. But
No. It's like the ideal. In other words, saying is I was married at age 33, but I was not born again until I was 25.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, from the moment I came to the faith, I was praying, Lord, I want to be with the woman that you've chosen for me. And, you know, I met her a few years later and we got married when I was 33. But I think, you know, you don't want to make rules, but I'm saying generally speaking, praying to get married young, to find the person that God has for you, generally speaking, is the right answer. And I think in our culture, we kind of get this other message constantly, like, well, you got to shop around, you got to see. There's a whole big downside to that. You can have your heart ripped out of your chest like five times, and if you think that's going to make you a better person, you're wrong. It would be much better for you to find one person or to guard your heart until you find the right person. I think that that's, again, it's another one of these cultural lies that you hear over and over and over again, or people say that, hey, if you're unhappy, you know, there's this better person out there for you. Even though you're married, it's not your soulmate, and there's another person out there for you. And I think there's a lot of danger in those views. And so, you know, again, we're living in a culture that's promoting some bad ideas, and we have to do our best to counter them as we're able.
Yeah, good point. Okay, that said, what do you and your wife disagree on most often?
Most often, you know, because my wife and I are one unit, one flesh, I would not dishonor her publicly by telling you what we disagree about. Ha!
Okay, that's a good
gotcha.
Point.
Gotcha.
I'm okay, but I will just let you
okay,
know
I'll
that
I'll give it to you. I'll give you the big one. The big one. You want the big one that's going to rip my marriage apart?
Yeah, because otherwise I was going to contact her and ask her.
It's like a meat locker in here.
Okay.
Temperature of the room.
Okay. All right. That's good. That's a good one. All right. What living person that you've actually met? So you got to pick a person you've actually met. What living person is so smart that they make you feel stupid?
Oh, there are several of those. There are several of those. John Zmirak is a friend that I have on my radio program about once a week. He doesn't quite make me feel stupid, but very close. He's just an amazing guy. I think that's now. If I had prepared, I could have come up with five answers to this. But right now, I'll just say John Zmirak. But he's too nice to really make me feel stupid, but very close. Where you realize, like, I'm an idiot. He knows everything. But I think it's good for us to be humble, to know that whatever we know, there's somebody who knows more. And whatever, however wonderful we are in one way, there's always going to be somebody more. And, you know, God gives us what he gives us. But there are, trust me when I tell you, there are a lot. I can't, they're not on the tip of my tongue right now. Okay. If I were a smarter person, I could tell you those names.
Okay, but I have the companion question for you here. This is what person that you've met in your life of sorts, what person is so godly that they make you question your salvation?
Nothing makes me question my salvation.
Okay.
Because my salvation is not based on what I do, as you know, mm-hmm. so you can't fool me with that question.
Mm-hmm.
You almost tricked me. But yeah, there are people, I think, that have a holiness about them that, you know, the pastors of Times Square Church, I sometimes preach at Times Square Church, which is here in New York. It's where I met my wife, actually. And the head pastor, Carter Conlon, there's a humility and a godliness to him, which is convicting. And I think that's kind of the idea, is that you want to be around people that are convicting, not in a way that is crushing, but in a way that actually makes you just sort of quiet and pause and think, maybe I should be more thoughtful. Maybe I should be more careful with, you know, my mouth, how I answer people quickly, rather than being a little bit more thoughtful and a little less fleshly in how I react to situations. And so there are a number of those kind of people in my life. The one that pops into my head is the pastor of Times Square Church, Carter Conlon.
Yeah. This is kind of a fakey answer because he's such a big deal now, but I used to go back in the day to Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis, and I always tell people whenever I think of John Piper, I remember him interacting with me at church. You know, and this was before social media, so he wasn't like all a big deal. And you just felt like whenever you talked to him, he was looking at you saying, Are you like even saved? I mean, honestly,
That's actually my problem with John Piper. I love John Piper. I was interviewed by him, and I finally got him to crack up. I thought that was like the holy grail to get him to laugh and have fun. But, you know, that can be religiosity, too. That's the problem, is that sometimes some people are very religious, and it makes you feel bad about yourself. And that's the opposite of, you know, the love of the Lord. And so I'm not accusing John Piper of that, but I think that he's so smart and he's so theologically astute that sometimes he can just make you feel, you know, like a worm, which, you know, it can have its benefits, but not always.
Yeah. Well, and he also was just like driving around Minneapolis in this beat up like station wagon and stuff. And, you know,
he told me that he just did that to make you feel bad.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. So, okay.
Yeah.
Now I know. Okay. Yeah. What this one I also should have given you more time to think of, but I'll see just what you come up with. I'm sure you get asked this a lot. What's the most interesting interview you've done, like, let's say in the last 6 months? I don't want to put myself in there because I was more than 6 months
ago. I won't say in the last 6 months. I've done a number of Socrates in the City interviews.
Okay.
People can find them. They're videos. You can go to SocratesInTheCity.com. But I had a number of conversations in Oxford, England. I guess it was 2 summers ago. And one of them was with a friend. His name is Michael Ward. He discovered this secret code in the Narnia books of C.S. Lewis. And the fact that that code existed is so completely mind-blowing that the conversation that I had with Michael Ward, you can watch it at SocratesInTheCity.com, but for me, it was one of the most scintillating, fun conversations that I've had. I really use fun as an arbiter. I've had a lot of fun conversations on my radio program. Just the other day, I had a conversation with Adam Carolla, who is so quick that it just becomes intense fun because you're joking with the person and they're joking right back with you. I'd never spoken to him, and you know, I'm not really that familiar with him. But some people just have this mind where you can just sort of, you know, dance at this high level, and that is a joy, and it's one of the great joys of doing my radio program is getting to talk to people like that. But Michael Ward, that's the one that pops to mind, I think, typically as it was an especially fun interview and conversation. Really fascinating on a number of levels.
Okay, that is the first time I've ever heard of a code in Chronicles of Narnia.
Well, but see, this is why I get so excited. I discover these things, and then after I go crazy having discovered it, I go crazy that the world doesn't know it. I think that something is really sick with the world that people that, I mean, one of the reasons I want to do TV is because I think that when you discover something like this, you say, where is this? Like, you flip around on TV, nobody's covering this. And you're thinking, what kind of an insane world is this that nobody is jumping up and down over this or this or this or this? And this is a classic example because, first, you're skeptical that there's a code and you have to be convinced that it's really there, which takes some doing because it's such an insane idea. And then when you see it, you think, this is the greatest literary discovery of the century, period. Nothing close. It's insane. And so I said, I'm going to get this guy on video. You know, I'm going to do a long interview with him. And I, in fact, connected him with a friend of mine who did stuff for the BBC. They made a documentary about it. But trust me, you know, I was an English major at Yale. This is big news from a literary point of view. And the world is shallow and stupid, so you're not hearing about this on TV. But you should hear about it. And so that's why I made the Socrates in the City thing. It is truly mind-blowing.
Wow. Okay, so what's something that people assume about you that's just not true?
That these are all my teeth.
Okay.
Just kidding. That was a joke. That was a joke. What would that
you
people
and George
assume
Washington.
About me? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people assume because I joke a lot and because publicly I'm sort of smiley and whatever, I think that people don't realize, like, my whole life I've struggled with depression and had a lot of tough stuff, but I just don't show that publicly, maybe because I'm ashamed or I'm too sensitive to, like, put it out there. But, you know, we have really, really, really struggled, and notice I said really three times because it was bitter for years until the Bonhoeffer book hit. Paying the rent was agony, and we were just desperately praying, Lord, you've got to deliver us. What are we going to do? Like, I'm trying to follow your will for my life, but it was really horrible. It was just bad. I've had a depression for my whole adult life, and I had chronic fatigue issues, and so it was a real huge battle. And you know, my wife was with me through most of it, and I have to say that, you know, when you get any measure of success, people sort of think like, oh, he's always had it easy, and it's just the opposite. I am so grateful to the Lord for whatever little platform I have right now, that the Lord knows that I am just like exploding with gratitude to Jesus, because it was very tough for a very, very long time until literally, you know, 6.5 years ago. We were struggling bitterly, bitterly financially. And, you know, I put on a happy face and I dressed nice, but believe me, it was very hard. And I know the Lord used it to humble me and to shape my character, at least to some extent. But it's something that, you know, a lot of people wouldn't know. But I say that because I know there are people going through tough stuff now, and you need to know that a lot of people who you would assume haven't suffered probably have. And, you know, most people go through it at one point or another.
Yeah, and that's actually great to say, because we have a lot of content on our site right now about depression and the value of solid professional counseling and kind of trying to take away that stigma to really get help and get community.
And medication. I mean, I'm on medication now. I take medication every day, and I think that, you know, it's depression is one of the worst things imaginable, and I have to tell you that, you know, having been through it, I walked through it with Jesus, and it's still really tough. And I think, what about people who don't know the Lord or aren't sure that he loves them? When you go through depression and stuff, I think it would just be an unbearable agony, and so my heart goes out. And so I speak about it publicly when I can, because I just want people to know, like, you know, it's normal. People suffer and struggle, and a lot of them, that ends up being depression.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. And actually, the question I want to ask you next, then, is under this assumption of, oh, you have a charmed life and all this kind of stuff, and, oh, in social media, we just need, you know, so many young adults are being told, or they're assuming that I need to be famous, I need to be, you know, this looking for the spotlight. Tell them, Eric, instead, from what you have learned, your body of experience and life, how not to be famous, but how to be significant.
Well, we are put on this earth for one reason: to know Jesus, to love him, to serve him. Like, that's it. And if you don't get that, you really don't get anything. That's the most basic thing. How you treat people who are suffering, how you treat people who are going through a hard time, those are the things that matter. Like, how great you look and how awesome your weekend was and how cool your friends are is worth less than nothing. I mean, that goes like in the devil's bucket, not in God's bucket. And I think that we have to really understand that either this is true or it's not. But, you know, when I'm doing everything that I'm doing, the reason I want to be famous is so I can have a platform for what I'm saying right now, because fame itself is dirty and gross. It's kind of like saying, "Why I want to have a house." You know, if your focus is not on serving God with your gifts and saying, "Lord, what have you given me?" If I really believe the Lord gave me a calling to speak through radio and TV and through books, if I was just doing that for my own glory, like to be famous, there's nothing more pathetic than that. Because when you die, who cares? Like, you wrote a novel a lot of people read. Did it change their lives for good? What did it do? I mean, honestly, I think that you have to know God, and you have to pursue him, and you have to know that either he is number one or you have gone wrong. Like, you're making a big mistake, because he loves you and he has a plan. And I really say that because no matter what I'm going through, I can turn to him. I can know that he's real, that he's there, and that it's not about success. I could die tomorrow. You know, unless you really know that, life is going to be hard. And I think that whatever I do, I want to serve him. And also, you have to have the humility to understand that maybe you don't know exactly what he wants you to do. So you have to have the humility to ask him to lead you and to say, am I getting this wrong, Lord? Am I just doing this for me? Just because, you know, like, and I'm not talking about people beating themselves up, but I'm saying really honestly saying, we're here for a short season. The older you get, the more you know that, and that you want to really say, Lord, what did you make me to do? What am I, you know, we celebrate things in our culture that are pretty worthless. Being a good father, a good mother, there is nothing more important than that. Being a good spouse, there is nothing more important than that. So you could be really successful and mess up on that, and it's like, well, then you have really messed up, because those are the most important things in the world. So, you know, I say this obviously from some experience, because I think that there are a lot of people chasing stuff that when they catch it, they're going to realize, why did I chase this again? So don't waste your time.
Yeah. Okay, so in light of that, last question. I have heard you say that you really try to be intentional about how you spend your time. So what is something that you really fight to make time for?
Well, it's become easier over the years, but time with my wife, my daughter, and my parents, because, you know, my parents are getting on in years, and I realize, like, I frittered away a lot of time over the years, and now I start realizing that the time with a handful of people in your life is really precious, and you can't say yes to everything, and you have to understand that is something, like, those are non-negotiables. Like, everybody can jump in a lake, because if you don't handle that stuff, you know, if you don't put your spouse first or your kids first or your parents first, whatever, and you don't realize that time with them means everything, the world can pull you away. And I know a lot of people that have made millions of dollars. I'm not one of them, but I know people who they did it at the expense of their families, and then you can't you can't go back to when they were 10, you know, like when you were like working 18 hours a day. And so I think that you have to really, really, you have to be careful. And by the way, you know, God really won't bless that. You can't take that shortcut.
Yeah. Well, folks, we have been talking, we were a little bit ago, about Eric's book, If You Can Keep It, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty, as well as just getting some wisdom and insight from him, and maybe just shooting the breeze a little bit about life and what he has learned from it. So, Eric, thank you so much for carving out some time for us and being part of this. Really is a privilege.
Well, it was a privilege and a joy for me. I'm just grateful that you care enough to ask me these questions, and I hope that it blesses some of your listeners. Anytime, this was a joy. When the world needs a hero, can you be the hero? When the world needs a miracle, can you be the miracle? You be the miracle. Safe and sound, inside of a bubble. But when the world needs a change, can you make a little trouble? Can you make a little trouble? Yeah, hey, make a little trouble. Gonna see it through. Believe in a love that makes all things new. Hey, make a little trouble. It's all good, I got you. Believe in a love that makes all things new. Hey, make a little trouble. I know it might exhaust you, but believe in a love that makes all things new. Hey, make a little trouble for something bigger than you. And believe in a love that makes all things new. Hey, when the world needs.
Well, as we open up our inbox, we get to have our Dr. Greg Smalley here. Hey, Greg.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Great to have you.
Thanks.
Thanks for carving out some time. We have a question from someone who is engaged and kind of has a dilemma. So you're going to need to weigh in here with this one. She says, I started dating my boyfriend last spring and he recently proposed to me. I said yes. We've been in a long distance relationship ever since the beginning. The problem is that within the first month of us dating, I went out with a guy friend to talk and catch up. We decided to go for a walk and we ended up sharing a kiss. I haven't told my fiance because at the time I didn't think it was a big deal. I know I need to tell him what happened months ago, but I'm terrified he's going to break off our engagement and never look at me the same. I don't want our marriage to start out with a lie and a secret that might come between us later on. I know this is going to hurt him, and that thought kills me inside. Should I wait to tell him face to face? Should I Skype or tell him over the phone? I won't see him in person again for another 3 weeks.
You know, I know that you made a huge mistake, and you get that. I hear it's terrifying to think about confessing this to your fiance, and I'd say, hey, applaud your courage. I would definitely have this face to face. I think part of what you're doing is you need to train one another that you're not going to deal with big issues via some sort of media device or text or whatever. I mean, this is definitely a face to face, and he deserves that respect from you. I hear for you, and obviously the biggest fear is he going to leave or is he going to break up? Have I ended this relationship based on my choice? Bottom line is this, that he needs the choice to move forward with you. If you don't tell him, in effect, you're manipulating him just to stay with him. And there's nothing loving about that. Love is free will. Love is choice. And he needs to know and he needs to have the information necessary to choose to say, you know what, I love you enough that we're going to work through this stuff. We're always going to face challenges within a marriage. But we need all the information. I mean, I routinely get this from people who are married who have affairs. And always, 100% of the time, I would say to that person, you absolutely need to tell because they need to have that choice. And you need to tell. Secrets are disastrous for a relationship because one, you in a marriage, you can't, if you're holding a secret like this, you can't 100% give your heart away. There's a part that you have to sort of quarantine off, silo off, and he doesn't deserve that and you don't deserve that. It takes so much energy to maintain a secret that's part of what's tough. I mean, the micro cracks that are forming because of the secret. I mean, all of that. So again, I applaud you. Your great choice. Don't keep the secret. Talk to him face to face. Before the talk, though, I'd do these two things. One, you need to get real, real clear what was going on for you that led to this kiss. If you just show up and start talking without really being able to say, okay, here's what was going on for me, that's going to feel really unsafe. I'm not sure that he's going to stick around if you're not sure what was going on. And you also need to decide, what did that kiss mean? I mean, is this really about you not wanting to be with him? I mean, you need to be real, real clear what that all meant and for you, what led to that and what does it mean? Mm-hmm. And offer that to him. And then you're going to have to be willing to just to really empathize and understand the hurt and the betrayal and all that. I mean, I hear you're engaged, but that you've taken your relationship to a very deep, deep level. It's the step before marriage. And so understand that he may be hurt. I would say this, though. You're going to really want to watch and pay attention to how he handles your heart and how he handles a challenge. I mean, if he rages, if he's calling you names, if he slams something, the door, hits the door, walks out, I mean, all that's good for you to be aware of, because that's not a healthy way to handle challenges. And again, I hear the betrayal, but this is also part of you watching how this is will give me insight into how he's going to handle my heart when you do make other mistakes. He will too. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they won't be this degree, but you guys are going to mess up. You're human. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to know how will we handle each other, so you can choose how you're going to handle his heart and how you're going to be honest and respect him and share this. And then you guys can move on. I definitely schedule some premarital counseling now. And if you guys choose to walk forward, use this as a way to have a stronger relationship. I can't tell you how many couples have gone from infidelity to a strong relationship. So God will use this. Again, the forgiveness, the redemption, I mean, all that is possible. So this truly is an opportunity. When James 1:2 says, consider trials an opportunity, this really is an opportunity. And your relationship will never be the same. And I mean that in a very good way. Either you guys are going to part, and that's a part of life, and that's a consequence, or it's going to make you stronger, and you guys will benefit from this and reap the rewards of this struggle. I mean, that's a awesome part of marriage, is just the struggles that we get to go through. An awesome part of marriage is dealing with the struggles, the hard times, and that's going to cause them to go to a deeper place of intimacy. So, you know, I get the fear. There is nothing you can do about that, but be courageous, be strong, walk through this and see how God's going to use it.
Okay. Thanks, Greg. Okay, folks, that's it for this week's show. We do want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org. Of course, we will see you around next week. In the meantime, happy Independence Day, both to our Canadian and to our U.S. friends. And, of course, you know, we'll have another show for you next week. And in the meantime, I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.